This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with J. Patrick O'Connor, author of the new book, The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
If you thought the Mumia case was just about a trial with millions of errors in it, that's not all that we're talking about. Mumia was framed.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we'd like to bring you some very important updates. One really unfortunate one, which is that the House of Representatives voted 203 to 129 to approve the new amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That's what everything you've been hearing about. Remember, a few years ago, the president was engaged in warrantless wiretapping. Originally, the House of Representatives said they were not going to pass any new legislation that might immunize the telephone companies that cooperated or in any way broaden the president's surveillance power. Well, guess what happened in the House? As I said, 203 to 129, a new piece of legislation amending the act has been passed. What does it do? First of all, it gives immunity to the telephone companies, something the House said they would not do or the Democrats said they would not do. Some of the so-called very liberal Democrats went with it. Pelosi, one of them. Steny Hoyer, who was the guy who actually put the bill together. Lots of other names you wouldn't want to see on the list voted in favor of the act. What does it do? It gives immunity to the telecoms, as I said, in a slightly different process than just straight immunity. What's required is that in court, the telecoms have to show that they got a presidential request to engage in the warrantless wiretapping, and it's not just hearing your phone conversations, it's all your email, to engage in it, and that the president said it was legal. Well, they're all going to do that. There's 40-some lawsuits. They'll all be dismissed, including one at the Center for Constitutional Rights, the ACLU, and everywhere else has lawsuits going. They'll all be dismissed as a result of that. The second thing the legislation does is it's normally okay or considered okay for the president to go wiretap people in Europe, Afghanistan, wherever around the world without a warrant. Not American citizens, but non-citizens. What this does is really say that if they're wiretapping someone overseas or looking at their email overseas, and they're in communication with an American, like lawyers from my office or other people, that they don't need a warrant to actually continue to do that monitoring and that surveillance despite the fact that Americans are on the phone. The third provision is this expansion of what used to be the three-day rule. In the old days, you could warrantlessly wiretap an American citizen, for example, for 3 days, then go to the court and try and get the application approved. They expanded it now to 7 days, and you can continue to do the wiretap no matter how long the process takes in the Foreign Surveillance Court. Even if you lose and you appeal, you can still continue doing it, which could be months or a year. Even if the government loses at the end, your government is still allowed to use the material collected during that, could be 1 year period. So it's basically a hole big enough to drive a truck through. Now, it's a huge issue, particularly for the Democrats who originally were going to stand against it, and particularly, unfortunately, for our presidential candidates, McCain, of course, being a Republican. McCain originally said he was going to be against warrantless wiretapping. He flip-flopped. Obama's people originally said that Obama would filibuster any legislation that had an immunity provision in it for the telecoms. He has now changed his position, and he now said he will vote for this piece of legislation. There's a huge campaign on to try and change the Senate vote and try and get them to vote against this telecom. But look, what are the chances? If Obama says he's going to vote for it, people like Schumer and Clinton and others, they're not going to want to undercut the presidential candidate by voting against it. So I think the Senate Democrats are going to go along with it. But it's just, it's really a warning to all of us that as much as you might want a particular candidate to win, the candidates don't change fundamental issues without really a huge grassroots movement and pressure. And they frequently, as there is happening in this case, move toward the center and move toward positions that really are antithetical to us as human rights people.
A rush towards the center in what you can only describe as a single ideology state. But I think what we have also lost here is an angle to impeach Bush. Because what Bush did in open defiance of the FISA law, and remember, the FISA law wasn't such great shakes to begin with. We were all against it. The FISA law set up this secret court in a room with no windows. They gave out 10,000 warrants to wiretap people and only turned down a couple in their history. And this wasn't even good enough for Bush. And Bush said openly, I'll wiretap people. I won't even bother going under the FISA law. He openly defied the law. This lets Bush off the hook.
I think that's a really important point. You know, this was something that Al Gore said was impeachable, and that he said was tyranny in America, the idea that Bush was engaging in warrantless wiretapping. And the Senate, whether dominated by Republicans or Democrats, never got it together to even hold a serious hearing where they demanded everything and actually started to condemn what the president had done here. And even when, who was the senator from Wisconsin?
If Russ Feingold.
Russ Feingold put in a censure motion. People went after him like he was like the devil himself. Even the Democrats went after him.
We have a Supreme Court case on the subject, U.S. v. U.S. District Court, that says the president can't engage in secret spying.
So this will be interesting to see, because the human rights groups, the ACLU, the Center of Basic, has said this is unconstitutional legislation. But of course, you have a very narrow Supreme Court now. You have four, you know, Neanderthals sitting at the bottom. And then you have the five who are moderates, maybe a couple liberals in there. And so you're going to lose four immediately, and can you pick up one of the others if and when this case gets there? Because you have to know about it to have standing that you're being wiretapped. And it is true that the district court, the case that was argued by Arthur Kanoy, came out of Detroit during the 70s, was warrantless wiretapping by John Mitchell and Nixon, and it was one of the first briefs I ever worked on in the Supreme Court, was the U.S. District Court case. And here we are again, only, 35 years later? We have a bit of sad news, which is the death of George Carlin, the stand-up comedian, quite a political comedian, but also very involved with Pacifica and WBAI in particular. As many of you may know now, there are seven words that none of us can say on the air and that none of you can hear on the air, and therefore I can't tell you what those seven words are. But they were banned in a case that went to the Supreme Court, in which WBAI was the station that went to the Supreme Court because they had been forbidden from using those seven words by the Federal Communications Commission. And the way the case arose is George Carlin did an album or a record in which he used those seven words because at that point they were banned on television stations, but not necessarily on radio. WBAI played the record on its station, and then the FCC made a complaint against the station that WBAI eventually took to the Supreme Court. 5-4, the Supreme Court upheld the Federal Communications Commission in its belief or in its rule that those seven words could not be spoken on the air. It's not just that we're sad about George Carlin because he was a sharp political comedian that really went after the establishment politicians and a lot of other people.
Religious leaders.
Right, religious leaders. It was really strong. But it was also very involved with the fact that across this nation right now, there's seven words that you can never hear on the air. You can hear them on cable. You can hear them in the street. They're common words, but we can't say them.
Well, the hypocrisy of it is that you can't say these seven words, some of which go back to the English language 1,000 years. On the other hand, they can show the most grotesque kinds of murder on TV while families are watching, and that's okay.
Now, here's the way Carlin's piece works. It says, begins, I love words. I thank you for hearing my words. And then he goes on, he says, I like to think that the same words that hurt can heal. It's a matter of how you pick them. There are some people that are not into all the words. There are some people that would have you not use certain words. There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are seven of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must be really bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over there, you seven bad words. That's what they told us they were, remember? That's a bad word. No bad words, bad thoughts, bad intentions, and words. You know the seven, don't you, that you can't say on television? And then Carlin says the seven bad words. Those are the heavy seven. Those are the ones that'll infect your soul, curve your spine, and keep the country from winning the war.
The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal is the title of J. Patrick O'Connor's new book, published by Lawrence Hill Books. In it, O'Connor argues that the former Black Panther journalist did not shoot and kill Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. O'Connor asserts that death row inmate Abu-Jamal was framed by the police, and that the actual shooter was Kenneth Freeman. Freeman died in 1985 and was the business partner of Mumia's brother. As listeners know, Mumia was tried and sentenced to death. O'Connor began to research the Mumia Faulkner case as an editor for the internet site crimemagazine.org. It was then that he read through all the trial transcripts and the Post-Conviction Relief Act, including several articles from the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News. Patrick is the editor and publisher of Crime Magazine and has worked as a reporter for United Press International, as editor of Cincinnati Magazine, and as associate editor of TV Guide. Welcome, Patrick, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the central thesis of your book, which is really novel and so important to the whole Mumia history and movement, tell us how you got involved and how you got interested in his case.
We lived in Philadelphia. I worked at TV Guide, also home box office. That's how we got there. And then in the late 70s and the early 80s, and this crime, the killing of Officer Faulkner, occurred in December of 1981. We were there when it happened and there for the trial. And we were also there during this major buildup of the MOVE versus Mayor Rizzo confrontation that really captivated the city. It was a top news story all the time in Philadelphia. I would listen to Mumia on the public radio station there. It's now called WHYY, where Terry Gross does the Fresh Air show. He would do a report at night about community issues, and particularly the downtrodden in the community. And I was very impressed with his reporting. And he had this most incredible voice I've ever heard on the radio. So when he was accused of this murder, it just didn't ring true to me. It didn't fit this image at all that I had of him. But time went on. I just thought, well, he must have done it, and didn't think about it very much. And then I started seeing, you know, like free Mumia signs here and there as you travel around. And then I saw in 1996 HBO played a BBC documentary called A Case for Mumia Abu-Jamal, A Case for Reasonable Doubt. And I thought that opened up a lot of issues that deserve to be looked at. So I now started discussing, I had a partner, we started this internet site called Crime Magazine. I started asking him, shouldn't I do something about this? And he says, no, I think he's good for it. That he looks very guilty. I mean, after all, he was found at a scene of a murdered police officer with a gun in a holster. So I didn't take up the story until 2000. Amnesty International did a pamphlet. I forget the exact title right now, but it was an 84-page pamphlet that basically stated that his trial was incredibly unfair, classic case of constitutional violations from the beginning to the end of it, from the jury selection right through the summation by the prosecutor. So after I read that, I decided I'd start looking into it just to write an article for Crime Magazine.
Now, Amnesty was concerned particularly with the unfairness of the trial, not really whether Mumia was innocent or guilty, the Amnesty pamphlet?
They took no position on his guilt or innocence, just that his trial failed to meet the standards for minimum justice in a case.
Right. That really has been, I think, for a lot of people with Mumia's case, has been the way they've gotten into the case. They say, you know, 28 reasons why it's an unfair trial. But what I think what's really groundbreaking about your book is that it asserts that Mumia was framed.
That's right. The subtext throughout all the research I was doing and the support I saw for Mumia was based on this idea that his trial was unfair. He very well may have killed Officer Faulkner, but he deserved a new trial. So without any preconceptions, I started looking. I read the transcripts, read the post-conviction relief hearings. There have been several books on this case. One of them by David Lindorf is extremely well done. Books about the MOVE movement and all that, and And what I could see, it took me 2 or 3 years of this research, was that a passenger in the car, this whole situation came to a head when police officer Faulkner pulled over Mumia's younger brother, Billy Cook.
What year was that?
1981. It's 3:55 in the morning. It's 9 degrees. It's December the 9th. It's in a red light district of Philadelphia, and his brother's driving this battered Volkswagen with a license plate dangling off the back and a wooden bumper. I mean, classic case where somebody should be stopped. This car should be stopped. So he pulls him over, and a confrontation between Officer Faulkner and Billy Cook ensues. One or two witnesses say that they saw Cook strike Officer Faulkner in the face.
Now, Cook is Mumia's brother?
His 25-year-old brother. Mumia's 27 at the time. Mumia is moonlighting as a cab driver. He's been fired from WHYY for lack of objective reporting, according to the station manager, specifically for his coverage of MOVE. They had a trial there, the MOVE 9 trial in 1979, that went on for almost a year. Mumia's coverage of it was overtly sympathetic, and so the station manager let him go. So Mumia is now doing freelance journalism on his own, doing individual interviews, but moonlighting at night as a taxi driver. And he happens to be, and this is the way fate goes, in a parking lot across the street when he sees Officer Faulkner subduing his brother Billy, Mumia's brother Billy, with a flashlight, 18-inch flashlight, literally beating his brains in, causing blood to come down on his neck and his brother's knees buckling. And Mumia sees this, and he runs toward the officer. Now, Mumia's in dreadlocks, and that's the signature sign of a MOVE member and to any police officer in Philadelphia. MOVE is a group to be feared and responded to with extra force. So I think Officer Faulkner would have been one of many, many officers whose reaction was to shoot this person running toward him at 3:55 in the morning. And Mumia is shot in the chest and a downward blow that lodges into his liver. One of the phoniest parts about the prosecution's case was how Mumia came to be shot. I mean, in the framing of it. This is why I called the book The Framing. They had Mumia coming up from behind, like some chicken move, coming up and shooting Faulkner in the back like Faulkner didn't even know he was there. Faulkner wheels around, and while falling to the ground backwards, gets off this shot at Mumia. Well, that bullet would have gone on an upward path and gone up the chest and then out toward the neck area. Well, the ballistics on this showed and was proven at trial when the surgeon testified about the direct downward path of this bullet, that the scenario the prosecution had could not have happened. And that's just one example of many of their scenarios that was falsified.
There was also compelling evidence about the so-called confession that Mumia made that came out months after police went on the record as saying that he made no comments in the emergency room when he was brought in dying, essentially.
That's right. Too weak to stand and very badly beaten at the crime scene when he was arrested. I mean, he's in a stupor. He's passed out from this gunshot wound. He's lost one-fifth of his blood content. He's in critical condition, meaning if he doesn't get surgery fairly soon, he's dead. He's brought to this paddy wagon where this officer bashes him in the face with this is a white shirt officer, a brass guy named Alfonso Giordano. He bashes him in the face with a walkie-talkie and makes up this alleged confession in the paddy wagon about, he said, I see you got a holster, where's your gun? He said, I dropped it in the street after I shot the officer. So they had this confession.
You're kidding. They published
it the next day in the paper. Police let that go out to the Inquirer and all the other media. The very first news round had him.
Patrick, let me ask you about Giordano, because from what I've learned from your book, Giordano really does capture the essence of this whole racist frame-up. Tell us about Giordano.
Giordano was part of this, he was the head of the stakeout unit that monitored MOVE all these years. You know, they had a stakeout that went over about a year where they barricaded the street going to the MOVE house in Powelltown in Philadelphia. He was also a part of this Civil Defense Bureau that they had, a special intelligence unit that had monitored Mumia since he was 15 years old when he joined the Black Panther Party. So he'd known him for 12 years. he was Mayor Rizzo's, Police Commissioner Rizzo's previously right-hand man on suppressing MOVE. He was the number one anti-MOVE guy, this Giordano. Now, you might ask yourself, how does he get there at 4:05 in the morning? It's, you know, a cold winter morning like that. How does he get there so fast in uniform? And he's part of this extortion deal where they're taking bribes from the bar owners and the pimps and prostitutes to stay in business. So he's down there, and that explains how he got there so fast. But he has this antipathy for Mumia that goes way back. And so he comes up with this alleged confession, and you'd think, well, that'd be the number one thing they'd lead the trial with. But in fact, Giordano never shows up in the courtroom.
Why is that?
He's put on ice. And the day after, the first working day after Mumia was sentenced to the electric chair, the police department made a release saying he'd been relieved of his duties on suspicions of corruption. And 4 years would go by before we'd know what these suspicions were when he'd pled guilty to tax evasion in connection with these bribes he'd been taking. He'd been earning like $3,000 a month in this extortion scheme that he and many others, 30 people went down on this, many of them higher ranking than Giordano. I mean, the guy that ran the Central Division where Faulkner worked went down on it. The deputy police chief went down on it.
But this wasn't raised at trial.
This never made it into the, and it never got in.
Which, the corruption part? Or
no, the fact that he had made this alleged confession in the paddy wagon.
Oh, the Giordano
now,
business.
Heidi's question earlier about this hospital confession. Let's take Mumia from the hospital, from the paddy wagon to the hospital. They assigned two officers to go with him. One's named Watskill, another's named Trombetta. They accompany him from the time he's in the paddy wagon, when Giordano's bashing his face in, till he goes into the surgery in the emergency room. As soon as they're relieved of that duty, detectives interview both of them separately, and Watskill, in his statement, says the Negro male made no comment. Trombetta, he's asked several times and reports several times, there was no comment made. This arrested person, this suspect, didn't say anything to me.
And so, didn't the doctor, wasn't an attending physician
yes,
there, also
Dr.
said he
Kodomo,
didn't, he could hardly
Kodomo
speak.
Kodomo said he never said a damn thing. In fact, he could barely speak. He was, as I said earlier, in this critical condition and so beat up. He had big-time lacerations to his face. His lung had collapsed, which makes it very difficult to talk. So anyway, we don't have the Giordano confession anymore. The prosecution lost that.
What do you mean they lost it? There's no evidence of it?
Well, I mean, they can't use Giordano.
Oh,
he's
right.
About to be indicted.
It. He's gone, right.
Okay, so,
right.
I mean, they're just afraid to bring
so
him
he's
forward.
He's gone. Right.
They can't use him. A few months go by. It's deep into February. The trial won't start till June, but it's now in February. And the prosecutor, Joe McGill, who to me is the real, I don't know, most despicable person in this entire scenario, in this entire tragedy of the Mumia case, he has a meeting with some police officers who were involved in the case, and one of them, who happens to be Officer Faulkner's best friend, a guy named Gary Bell, he says he heard Mumia say, I went over to see who shot my partner. He said he boasted to me, I shot the MF, but the whole word, and I hope the MF dies.
This is when Mumia's laying on the ground,
at the
scene of the accident, at the scene of the shooting.
In the emergency room on those.
Oh, in the emergency room.
On the emergency room, on the floor before you get into the emergency room, on those little trudgels, those things that open and shut the door. He's just lying there. His hands are cupped behind his back. He's kind of on his side. He hears this. This is what he reports Mumia saying.
This is what the partner, sort of best friend of Faulkner reports.
So they also, McGill.
The partner wasn't at the scene of the crime.
No, Faulkner worked alone that night.
But he went right to the hospital.
Went to the hospital.
Bell did.
He did.
Right.
And so did many other police. There were 25, 30 police in this hospital.
And that's when he supposedly got this, what you would call a gurney confession or something, right?
Right. That kind of thing. Well, they got it corroborated by this security guard at the hospital named Priscilla Durham, who told McGill, took Gary Bell one better. She said, he said it twice. Same basic language, but he shouted it out in defiance and arrogance. He shouted it out. Okay, here's a room teeming with police and emergency personnel, not one of whom reports this. And the two officers that I mentioned earlier, they don't hear it. It's odd to me that Gary Bell would say, he just said it to me. He didn't shout it. He just said it. And then Gary Bell said at trial, I don't recall even seeing Priscilla Durham at the hospital that night. She was there, but he didn't recall seeing her. So now they've got this concocted confession, which is very powerful in front of a jury, when you can add to it the arrogance of it, the audacity of saying this to a police officer about his best friend.
It just seems like, but
it was an overpowering thing for a jury to hear.
It's true, except if I were sitting on me, but, you know, it seems an unbelievable statement that somebody who just supposedly had shot a cop would then start bragging to the next guy.
If you're the real arrogant type, like, you know, you got the dreadlocks and everything, I mean, people could believe it. The jury did believe it and bought it.
No, because they believe the whole thing about move and they believe all that stuff. So it fits in that context.
Don't forget that when the defense challenged the prosecutors for knocking off the jury, all these black people who might have been on the jury, those black people weren't sitting on the jury to hear this and make a judgment about it. That jury was overwhelmingly white. And
it was 10 white, 2 black, right. The jury that made the guilt decision. It started off as a 3 blacks, 8 white jury. But on the first day, a black juror went home to take care of her cat, asked the judge for permission, denied. She did it anyway. Was gone an hour and a half, came back, admitted she did it, and was let go the next day.
And yet, didn't Judge Sabo, the presiding judge, allow a white person to take off time in a similar fashion and remain on the jury?
He did. There was a male white juror, who had a civil service exam scheduled during the trial. Now, that would normally be reason not to let a person on a jury. You'd get excused for that very reason alone. But they let him sit, and then when his date came, I think it was like a Wednesday afternoon, they recessed the trial the entire afternoon and sent one police officer with this, one court marshal with this juror to take his civil service exam. Now, he could be walking by every news box in town seeing headlines about this case, and the woman who goes on for the cat doesn't, you know, she just goes to her apartment and comes right back. It was facetious in the sense of, if you're trying to protect the sequestration of the jury, that letting somebody go home to their apartment with a marshal would be the way to do it. That's all it takes.
I do want to discuss the jury issues more as we go forward. We will. But I want to go back. We left you with the case with this so-called confession at the hospital sort of issue. And from that point, is that the key piece of evidence in the case, really?
That's really, well, the Giordano arranged for 2 witnesses at the scene to nail Mumia. One was a 21-year-old prostitute named Cynthia White with 38 convictions in the last 3 years. I mean, that's a lot of convictions in three years' time. And a cab driver named Robert Chobert, who was a 23-year-old felon, a felon on probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail into a schoolyard during the school day.
Nice guy.
Giordano at the scene sends Cynthia White in a patrol car to the police station to give her statement.
Cynthia White is the...
is the prostitute, right. The 21-year-old prostitute. He has every other witness but her come into the paddy wagon and attempt to identify Mumia, including Chobert and a bunch of others. Mm-hmm. But her, he doesn't even bother, doesn't even have the pretense of doing that, just sends her off down there. And she gives a statement. It's going to cause him a lot of trouble because, you know, you'd say make up some story. She just did the best she could. And she said, well, I saw this man, this black man, run across the parking lot, and from as far as 10 yards away, he started firing bullets. 5 bullets, 6 bullets. Well, Mumia's gun had 5 chambers in it. So they rearrested her. Even after she gave her statement, she gave them a phony address. They couldn't find her. So they arrested her again, brought her in 2 days later. And she then expanded her statement to say that she saw Billy Cook, Mumia's brother, hit Faulkner in the face. That's all, though. She didn't change anything about the 10 yards away and firing all these bullets. 5 days go by. They arrest her again. And this time she says, she tailors this statement now to fit what the actual evidence showed, that Faulkner was shot from within 1 foot. The bullet that killed him was fired at very close range, if not point blank, you know, like somebody right on his back shooting down at him. So she now gets this, changes her statement to do this. And they do the same tricks with this Robert Chobert. His first statement, he said the shooter had run 30 feet before collapsing.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. If you're just tuning into Law & Disorder, we're talking with J. Patrick O'Connor, author of the new book, The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Now, well, Mumia collapsed right at the scene. I mean, he's shot and he goes right down. He doesn't run, doesn't go a foot. So Chobert, he best he could trim this was to 10 feet. At trial, he says he ran 10 feet. So you've got the bookends here are the testimony of these two witnesses. Nobody else claimed to see how Faulkner was shot. And nobody, by the way, claimed to see how Mumia was shot other than Cynthia White said, oh, I think while he was falling down and he reached for something. That was as close as they could get to how Mumia was shot. So on the one end, you have this perjured testimony from these two witnesses, totally compromised, manipulated witnesses, and then you have the hospital confession. So that's a 1-2 punch that goes right to a guilty verdict.
And that's the main evidence, really, against
that's the evidence.
Boy, it really sounds incredibly flimsy when I hear you describe
no ballistics it. Evidence, no forensics right. evidence, none of that
wow,
stuff.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Patrick yeah. O'Connor, you've written The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Let me jump to the central question here. Who do you think did it and why?
I'm convinced that Billy Cook had a street vendor partner. He grew up with him named Kenneth Freeman. Kenneth Freeman ran a Center City kiosk that dealt in novelties, and Billy Cook had a table. They worked together every day, and they were together all the time. They were inseparable pair. After work, they would go out and chill out and have a few beers. In fact, there was a six-pack of beer in the back of the VW that night, and that's what they would do after work. They'd drive around, hit a few bars, have a few beers. Freeman's the passenger, and I know it for I can tell you for a number of reasons why he was the passenger. I mean, I think I can actually, you know, with preponderance of evidence, prove that he was the passenger. But what I say happened was he sees, by the way, Cynthia White, when she first described the situation, she's got Faulkner approaching the passenger side of the car, not the driver's side. And the passenger gets out of the car. She testified to this at Billy Cook's assault trial. So we already know there's some passenger there. And then we have the further fact that in Faulkner's shirt pocket is a driver's license application found on his clothing after, you know, he's dead and they take him to the hospital and they go through his clothing. There's a driver's application in there. And it has the name Arnold Howard on it. So the police go and arrest Arnold Howard pre-dawn, right away, bring him in. And he says, oh, hell, I gave that the other day to my friend Kenny Freeman. He's got it. So the police go and get Kenny Freeman. They bring him down, put him in a couple of lineups. He's picked out twice by Cynthia White in the lineup. So when Joe McGill, this prosecutor, turns over, the prosecution has to turn over its anything that's exculpatory, they call it Brady material, to the defense pretrial. They turn over the driver's license application, but they say it was found in the VW. They don't say it's found on the officer's person. So here's the scenario as I saw it. Freeman's seen Faulkner beating the stuffings out of Billy Cook, buckling his knees, putting him on the ground. He then sees Mumia run up from the sidewalk and get shot right in the chest. Freeman is an Army veteran, according to Billy Cook in an affidavit he gave in 2000, always armed with a .22, and a tough customer, a burly guy. He gets out of the car. Right after Mumia goes down, he's going to do something about it, and Faulkner grabs him. A cab driver drives by the name of this Robert Harkins, another cab driver. This is, you know, this section's alive with cabs. And he sees the officer grab him, and they wrestle, and Freeman wins this wrestling match. Faulkner goes to the ground on his hands and knees. He shoves him down hands and knees with his back now facing Freeman. Freeman shoots Faulkner at very close range in the back. Faulkner rolls over. He was on his hands and knees. Now he rolls over. He's on his back, and he shoots him between the eyes. This is what the cab driver saw and reported to the police within an hour of the shooting.
That's amazing.
So that's how we get Freeman. I mean, the fact that Cynthia White would say, you know, that Faulkner went up to, and another witness said Officer Faulkner first approached the passenger side of the car. At trial, and this is one of the most underhanded things I've ever seen a prosecutor do. When Cynthia White took the stand, he says to her, tell me, was there anyone at that scene other than the defendant, Mumia, the officer, and Billy Cook? She says no. So this essential deception that he has to get in right away before the defense, you know, prosecution goes first, before the defense can introduce anybody who would say they saw somebody running away, there wasn't anybody to run away. There was only these three people there. So I find that, you know, reprehensible and incredible. I mean, this man should be in prison himself.
And isn't it true that Cynthia White is now living in a condominium, possibly subsidized by the Philadelphia Police Department?
Well, I couldn't say. I've heard the rumor, but that's a long time ago. That was like, you know, in the 90s I heard that. I heard that. Now, she was declared officially dead. Mumia had a, as everybody does, who's convicted of a capital crime, you have a right to a Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing, which occurred in 1995. At that hearing, the DA's office in Philadelphia brought in a death certificate that said Cynthia White is dead. Now, on the death certificate, it said Cynthia Williams, not Cynthia White, and no, the fingerprints don't match Cynthia White. So on the Mumia side, the doubter, I mean, the people who think Mumia is being unfairly disadvantaged here by the way the government and the DA's office conducts themselves, they don't think she's dead. And one officer, one Philadelphia officer said at one point he thought Cynthia White was being kept in Cherry Hill, which is a New Jersey suburb of Philadelphia across the, you know, the Walt Whitman Bridge, kept there in a condo.
Over the past maybe 10 to 15 years, it's turned out that, for example, the woman who witnessed the security guard who said she heard the confession has recanted and said that she was lying, and other witnesses have come forward and said that the police department pressured them into lying.
Yes. Let's take Priscilla Durham first. She has a stepbrother named Kenneth Pate, who, in a telephone conversation with her, now Kenneth Pate was in prison at the time, but he's talking to his stepsister. He says to her, why did you testify against Mumia? And she says, they forced me to. In fact is, Priscilla Durham had been laid off, wasn't a hospital guard when she told Joel McGill about the alleged confession. Got her job back, though. When she came to trial, she had her job. Anyway, Kenneth Pate did an affidavit saying that his stepsister had recanted. Now, she disavows this. Veronica Jones is another one that I could mention here. She was one of the witnesses the defense had who said she saw somebody running away. She said she saw two black men running from the scene right after she heard the gunshots. She was about to testify at Mumia's trial for the defense when two detectives visited her in her jail cell. She was in jail for very serious charges, very serious felony charges, robbery, assault, possession of an instrument of crime. She was looking at 15 years on those charges. She also is around 21 years old and a mother. She doesn't want this to happen. And they say to her, you work with us. You didn't see anybody run. You didn't see anybody. You don't know anything about this case. And she went into, when the Mumia's attorney, Anthony Jackson, called her to the stand, she disavowed even signing any statement that this wasn't her. She didn't see anything, doesn't know what he's talking about. At Mumia's post-conviction hearing extension, they opened it up again in 1996 to take her testimony because she was now willing to recant 14 years later. Her conscience had gotten to her, and she, under a threat of perjury from Judge Sable, who conducted the post-conviction hearing, the same judge who was at the trial, it's an incredible fact, but that's the way it was. She describes how these two officers came in and made this deal with her, coerced her. I mean, they're giving your, here's your choice, 15 years right now, goodbye, or you didn't see anything, and your reward is, and her reward was, 5 years probation, not one day in jail, on three felony charges. Wow.
Patrick, what happened to Freeman and his friend Mumia's brother? Where are they now?
Billy Cook is in Philadelphia. After I tell you what happened to Kenneth Freeman, I think you'll know why we don't know where he is. Kenneth Freeman was the night that the police firebombed the MOVE compound on Osage Avenue, a townhouse on Osage Avenue in Philadelphia, in 1985. 60 other row houses went down with this one row house, a whole city block was exterminated. 11 people were killed. That night, Kenneth Freeman's body is found nude, gagged, and cuffed in a empty parking lot, empty lot in Philadelphia.
The same night as
night.
The...
Now, that to me, you know, you say, well, that's a hell of a coincidence.
Right.
Well, it really is. I mean, it's just too much. I mean, it's like to me, this is, they're tying it all up.
Right.
This guy's now paying. Tonight's the night he pays.
Right, to get rid of Freeman.
Move paid that day.
Right.
Only one Move adult survived that fire.
Yeah, they killed the leader, John Africa. They killed 5 children.
They not only killed John Africa. I mean, they burned down the house and they killed 11 people, 6 adults, 5 kids. John Africa's body is found with pellets in its back. His corpse is beheaded.
Ah.
Wow.
How bad was this hatred between the Philadelphia police and MOVE?
Yeah. Yeah. And you say Mumia's brother has disappeared somewhere.
He's afraid for his life ever since. He didn't testify at trial. He didn't testify at the PCRA hearings in 1995. He has warrants for him for petty stuff. He's afraid that if he did come forward, they'd put him in jail. And if he got in jail, or if they knew where he was, what happened to Freeman could happen to him. So he's what they call in the wind.
Let me fast forward this up to current times. The appeal was argued before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and much to our dismay and surprise, was lost. I understand the Batson challenge on the racial knocking off blacks from the jury was lost. There were other challenges that were lost. So where do we stand now?
We stand now, by the way, I was incredulous at that ruling. It was a 2-1 ruling on, like we'd say, party lines. Two Republicans voted against it. The main issue there was this Batson claim. Did the prosecutor use discrimination? All right. That court had, on two previous occasions, granted Batson claims where the reason they didn't grant it in this case, they said, was they didn't know the racial composition of the jury, the whole jury panel. So for the prosecutor struck 10 out of 15 people he struck were black. That's a strike rate of 66.7%. Well, maybe the jury was 66.7%. Right.
Maybe the
black.
Whole panel, like the 200, might have been 66.
Yeah.
And
that's
therefore,
that,
that's so
if
the
you don't
excuse
know,
they
if
made.
You don't know the right. composition of the whole jury, then the strike right. rate, you can't really.
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. the argument they used. But it's a disingenuous argument because in 2004, in a case called Holloway versus Horn, and in 2005, in a case, these are both Third Circuit cases,
yeah.
Brinson versus Vaughn, they granted a Batson claim without any record of the jury composition.
So this is the Mumia exception.
This is the Mumia exception. Where does he go from here? He can go on bank. He can go to the Third Circuit and ask for an on bank where all the active judges, not the senior judges, but just the active judges would sit and hear this oral argument again on the Batson claim and on the other claims. The barrier, though, is kind of high. The majority of the sitting judges, there's 12, 3 of whom recuse themselves already. This case is so politically charged that, you know, 1/4 of that panel has already said, I'm out. Keep me out of this. I can't participate because of conflicts of interest, basically, is what when you're recused from a case kind of, sort of means. Right. So there's 9 judges left. 5 of them would have to vote to sit. Now, the opinion was written by the chief judge, a Reagan appointee. 4 of the 5 judges were appointed by George W. Bush. 4 of the 5 last judges, okay? So his chances of getting an en banc are slim. Let's say that. I hope I'm wrong, but I think they're very slim. His other option, if he doesn't get the en banc, is to petition the Supreme Court, which has 3 times before turned him down. But since the Third Circuit went against, they altered the Batson ruling. 1986, the Supreme Court passed this Batson ruling. It's been a sacrosanct ruling that's been respected in all the district courts
And the Supreme Court's been good on this issue.
Been good on it.
They have the Miller L case.
Just expanded it.
Right, it just expanded it.
In a case called Snyder, they just expanded Batson. It used to be you had to prove an inference of discrimination on the part of the prosecutor in the whole panel selection. Like you could pick up a little trend. Now, under Snyder, you just have to have one juror. You have to have the inference that he did it to one juror.
Wow.
Not to like three or four jurors.
Yeah. Amazing.
So the Supreme Court would have a very easy way to deal with this case without having to make a ruling. It's just remand the case to federal district court and say, have the Batson hearing. You should have had it. I think its prerogatives have been stepped upon. I mean, they're the Supreme Court. Do you want some lower court coming along and saying, oh, if you don't know the jury panel's constitution, that's a qualification? Well, they didn't insert that qualification.
Right, and now that you just said it, they never even had the so-called Batson hearing, which is to say they never had a hearing on what the composition was or what the any chance to examine people.
They never had the hearing. The Batson hearing would bring the prosecutor before a federal judge, and he would then have to explain his reasons for each of the 10 black jurors he peremptorily removed. Now, he would say, well, one couldn't hear very well. He's gone on record in previous things. He said one couldn't hear very well. But that black juror said right in the transcript, I hear fine when my hearing aid's working. There was a white juror who said she didn't hear very well. He impaneled her. There was one black juror who said she'd been recently divorced. Well, he impaneled white jurors who had been divorced. That type of thing. So those are inferences. All you need is what they call a prima facie case. Just a obvious. Something so obvious as that. You know, you sit one who says he can't hear that well, and then you sit another one who can't. That kind of thing.
Well, how many judges would he need on the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to remand it for a Batson
hearing? About three. You don't need much. I mean, it's not easy to get, but you don't need the whole panel to do it.
I think really why we're so excited about your book, and I know so many others are, is that it really provides a new rallying cry around which the public can sort of renew their sense of outrage about this case.
I think that's right, Heidi. I mean, you know, because I go on speaking tours around Mamiya's case, and I did one in California a year or so ago. And up until then, it was a very complex argument about his innocence. I mean, people were all over the place. And your book really puts it into a few key facts that were used to convict him. And I think I agree with Heidi, it's really important in that respect.
Yeah, the prosecution was so over the top against him. It was so rigged. You know, here you have a guy with a gun and a shoulder holster and a dead officer. It shouldn't have been that hard. I mean, to go in through all these extra hoops, you know, getting perjured testimony, phony witnesses, concocting hospital confessions. I mean, they didn't use the evidence in the case. That's
well. What
that's
about the judge
point.
Really being part of the prosecution? What could you tell us about Szabo?
Well, he sent more people to death row than any judge in the United States. He did.
They called him the hanging judge.
The hanging
because
judge.
Of that.
They called him a prosecutor in robes.
Wow.
And he was a member of the Fraternal Order of Police.
And he was. He was.
Wow. You know, when I was recently in Philly, I was driving along Daniel Faulkner Way, and it's quite incredible the sort of force of the police.
Tremendous.
In terms of trying to sway public opinion about that.
They're very, very active. Anytime you see a Mumia rally, you're going to anywhere in Philadelphia, you're going to see a counter demonstration by the FOP.
Yeah, I've seen it.
I have a question about a couple other characters whose names I hear a lot. One is the governor, Rendell, who ultimately Mumia would have to go to for any kind of a pardon. And wasn't he in some way, was he the prosecutor at the time? What was his role?
He was the DA.
The DA, right.
He's the one
I don't mean the actual prosecutor.
He's the one who selected Joe McGill to be the prosecutor. Governor Rendell ran part of his campaign on fulfilling the death sentence for Mumia. So there will be no pardon coming from Ed Rendell, let's say that.
What about one other person? This woman, is she now the DA, Abraham?
Yeah, Lynn Abraham.
And she's also played a role here.
She was. She was a judge then, and she's the one who arraigned him at his hospital bed. I mean, she couldn't wait for him to get into a courtroom. She gets over to the hospital and arraigns him there while he's tethered, chained to a hospital bed with three guards in the room.
Huh. Patrick, what about Mumia still being on death row now for over a quarter of a century? Is he going to get off death row?
You know, the last time he should have gotten off, they had 2001 when Judge Yon lifted the death sentence. He should have been removed right then. Yeah. But Lynn Abraham petitioned the judge to say, while the case is under appeal, would you keep him on death row? And incredibly, Judge Yon agreed.
That's amazing.
It really was. Yeah. It was really, yeah.
really nasty.
You know, spiteful, I guess, is what you'd say. Incredibly spiteful. They can still keep him on death row. They can do the same argument that until all of his appeals are exhausted.
It's really crazy because he technically hasn't been sentenced to death at this point. It's been vacated, the death sentence.
Right, but we're...
The fact that he might be facing a death sentence doesn't put you on death row.
No, but Mumia's attorney has asked for an on-bank hearing, so the appeal process continues. And when they ask for an on-bank hearing on their issues, the DA's office goes in and asks for an on-bank hearing on reinstating the death penalty.
Right, of course.
I mean, they're not just going to hear Mumia's three claims.
I understand, right. Yeah. They're going to also hear, should we reinstate the death penalty?
They're going to say, let's get the death penalty back.
And that's, of course, the risk that you take by appealing at all to on-bank. He's going to wind up with a bunch of conservative judges who may want to reinstate the death penalty. I don't think they
will. Highly unlikely.
Yeah, I think that's highly
unlikely in that case, because the violation at the instructions to the jury by Judge Sable were so bad that even Judge Young could see that.
They were really shocking, I recall. Yeah. What was the most – I'm trying to remember from your book, there was a very couple of shocking lines in there in the instructions. What were they?
He didn't explain to them about the mitigating circumstances.
That's right.
You know, that anything –
That they needed unanimity, apparently.
Unanimity, and you had to be unanimous. Right. He didn't make it clear that they didn't have to be unanimous in order to recognize mitigating circumstances and spare his life.
Right.
Never been arrested once in his life was a mitigating circumstance.
And we should just explain to our listeners that death penalty jurors have to weigh what are called aggravating and mitigating circumstances, looking at sort of the whole picture of the background of the defendant.
And they had one major aggravating circumstance. The killing of a police officer in the
line
of duty.
Which is a statutory aggravator.
Statutory, major. You can't get a higher aggravating circumstance than that. So they had that, but there were numerous mitigating circumstances.
Never been arrested in his life.
In fact, the only thing he ever had on his encounter was a jaywalking ticket he got in Oakland, California when he was selling the Black Panther newspaper.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all he had. He was a devoted family man, respected in the community, had just been recently head of the Black Journalist in Philadelphia, been named one of the 81 people to watch by Philadelphia Magazine. He was a very respected member of the community, and he had his attorney didn't bring any witnesses in at the sentencing phase to talk about his character. You know, what they call ineffective counsel, if I've ever heard it. But he had all these wonderful mitigating circumstances that the jury didn't consider because they thought, unless all 11 of them agreed on it, that there was no point.
Well, Patrick, you've written this wonderful book, The Framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm going to ask you what you would suggest for our listeners to do to help Mumia. The first one is obvious. Read the book. You got any other suggestions for
us? The book is very convincing. I can tell you, as someone who's traveled and done a lot of work on this case, that it really makes really clear that we're talking about an innocent man here who was framed.
There was a time when in the Mumia era when they were having sellout concerts at raising lots of money. When Leonard Weinglass and Mike Farrell and Ozzie Davis were behind this campaign in the mid-90s, there was a lot of money raised for this campaign, but that's really dried up. There are a number of Mumia's sites that you can find on the Internet, a number of them, and Pam Africa runs one, International Concern Family and Friends, and there's journalists from Mumia. There's a bunch of them. His defense fund, this money that was raised went to the National...
It went to the Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, which goes 100% to pay for the legal fees.
The checks were written to whom, though?
They're made out to the National Lawyers Guild Foundation, which is the fiscal conduit for the committee.
That would be, if you say one thing, that would be what I'd say.
A link on our website to that.
Make checks out to that group, and they support his legal defense, which is far from over.
It certainly is. It's very far from over. I mean, you have not only on bank, you have Supreme Court, you have the resentencing, if that's all he's left with. So you have a long time yet and a lot of work.
Patrick, have you visited with Mumia?
You know, I tried, and I asked Frances Golden, his literary agent, if Mumia ever got any of the stuff I sent him. She talked to him last week. She said he never got anything.
They kept it from him in the mail.
He's got the book now. I was sending him, manuscripts as I was going through and letters to him, telling him what my intention was, that I was just trying to get to the facts of this case. But I never did hear back from him, and I'm now that I know Frances Golden and other people, I think I'll have the opportunity to go out and see him.
We owe a debt of gratitude to you for this important book.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really a terrific book. I mean, I picked it up, just not knowing what to find, what I'd find, and I was really, really surprised.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
It was great to be here. If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.